With support from Verde Gallery and Verdant News and Coffee, 17 East Taylor Street in downtown Champaign, a place of inspirations where community and culture converge. Verde Gallery is currently showing Distant Voices Nearer, a celebration of American Indian art.
It's 106. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580, the Information Advantage. I'm Tom Rogers, in for Celeste Quinn. We go to the archives today for our interview segment at 106. Back in August of last year, Celeste talked with Gary Latterman about death and the American culture. She took your calls back then, but obviously this is a pre-recorded program, so no calls today.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, we take a look at American funeral rituals over the last 100 years with Gary Latterman, an associate professor of American religious history and culture at Emory University. Latterman is the author of Rest in Peace, A Cultural History of Death and the Funeral Home in 20th Century America. In his book, Letterman looks back to another book about how we handle the dead, Jessica Mitford's The American Way of Death. That book, published 40 years ago this month, became a huge bestseller. It's still in print. Mitford's book blasted the practices of the funeral business. Were her observations and complaints on the money? That's one of the questions we'll take up with Letterman this afternoon. In his book, Gary Latterman examines the business aspect of funeral homes, but he also looks into other aspects of the industry, emotional, psychological, religious, and cultural aspects of death. Listeners, I invite you to join us with your questions and comments. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. Here are the numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Gary Latterman is Associate Professor of American Religious History and Culture at Emory. In addition to Rest in Peace, he is the author of The Sacred Remains, American Attitudes Toward Death, 1799 to 1883. Rest in Peace, A Cultural History of Death and the Funeral Home in 20th Century America is published by Oxford University Press. Again, the telephone number is 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Professor Latterman, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
Oh, my pleasure. What an interesting book. What an interesting topic. Let's talk a little bit about Mitford's book first. Her book, you say, permanently changed the public face of death in America. What essentially did she have to say about the funeral industry?
Essentially, she had to say things that had been said about the funeral industry up until 1963. There's always been a cloud of controversy over the rise of the funeral industry, but she just had a way of writing. It was a very entertaining book. It was very humorous. I love it. And it had a huge cultural impact.
Yeah. And if she died in 1996, and as I mentioned, the book is still in print, does it continue to have an impact on us?
I think less so today than it did in 1963 and into the 70s. It was just reissued in a revised edition, and it didn't really arouse all that much press or interest when it was when the new edition came out. She was just really in the face of the funeral industry, and there was a ripple effect, I think. I mean, it was a huge popular success on the New York Times bestseller list for months, and the nature of her arguments really spread out through popular culture, and people would rely on her or refer to her to really find a way to blast the industry.
Yeah. And you say it was just the right mixture of wit and outrage.
Exactly. And it really was capturing a moment, I think, in American consumer history, where, you know, just about every other arena of consumerism and the marketplace had been, you know, finding ways to empower the consumer. And for many, the funeral is sort of off limits. It's a very unusual kind of market. But in a way, her book really led to the empowerment of the consumer and the essential need in American capitalist society for consumers to have choices.
Mm. How did the funeral industry, how did funeral directors respond to her book?
Well, they were generally upset and outraged by it, of course, especially because it just got so much publicity. But they felt she got it wrong. I mean, there were all kinds of efforts to counteract the public perceptions that she was helping to reinforce, but they never really had any answer that was really effective in the long run to her arguments.
Mm. And from your view, was she right or wrong about the funeral industry?
Oh, again, I think it's a great read, but I think she got it mostly wrong. And as you said in the introduction, there is more to funerals and death in society than just economics, and she mainly was looking at the economics of funerals and rehearsing what had been a very familiar refrain in popular culture about the high cost of funerals and how outrageous they were. But the cultural, religious, psychological aspects of funerals, I think, make it a more complicated picture.
Yeah. Well, you know, this business of funerals and how expensive they are, this has always been an issue, hasn't it? Or maybe not. I don't know. You quote Mark Twain in the book, Life on the Mississippi, part of the dialogue between Twain and an undertaker, and, you know, talking about, you know, there's one thing in this world that a person will not say, look around a little. I'll look around a little when it comes to shopping for a coffin. And if I can't do better, I'll come back and take the one you're showing me.
Well, yeah, Twain really depicted what I think was beginning to evolve into a full-flown kind of stereotype about the industry, and especially about the personality and character traits of the undertaker. Before the Civil War, there is no funeral industry. I mean, it was mainly a kind of rural, communal affair. The funeral industry really comes of age in the late 19th and early 20th century. And from the moment the industry really emerges, there are a number of people who are publicly critical of the funeral industry, particularly because of the costs, but also because of embalming and the manipulations that were beginning to take place in how a body was presented. The embalming really becomes the cornerstone of the funeral industry, and it is seen as excessive and unnecessary and symptomatic of some kind of excess.
Mm. When did the practice of embalming begin?
Well, to be honest, that's my first book. The Sacred Remains really looks at the impact of the Civil War on American attitudes toward death. And we really begin to see embalming to emerge on the scene during the Civil War, where Northern families wanted to find a way to ship the remains of their fathers, sons, brothers back north out of the so-called profane Southern soil. So there are a few families who begin to do that, and enterprising undertakers who experiment with embalming as a way to preserve the body. Another key moment, of course, is Abraham Lincoln and his body, which went on a 20-city funeral tour, and his body was embalmed and put on display, and newspapers were very graphic in their descriptions of what kind of manipulations were made and interventions were made on the president's body, because, of course, his casket was open for hundreds of thousands of people to see in each city.
And did that then begin to lead us to a widespread acceptance of embalming?
That's what I argue. Yeah. I think so. Again, before the Civil War, embalming would be really unheard of, except maybe in the basements of medical schools. No one would ever allow it or even think about it. It's because of the technological advances that you really see it take shape and become widespread in the late 19th and early 20th century.
Mm-hmm. Well, now let's move back to 1963. Jessica Mitford's book has been published, The American Way of Death, and one of the people it had an impact on was Robert Kennedy. 1963, the year President Kennedy was assassinated.
Yes.
How did Mitford's book affect the Kennedy family and the decisions made following the president's death?
After his death, in the immediate craziness of that time, there were questions about, well, what should we do about a funeral and what should we do with the body? And apparently Robert Kennedy had just finished reading Jessica Mitford's book. I mean, the assassination's in November, just a few months after the book is published. So it's really an incredible convergence of these events, but there was a great deal of public discussion about funerals and what they cost and whether the body should be displayed. And those discussions had an impact on Kennedy, who according to the records, actually brought up Mitford's book when they were thinking about just exactly how to handle Kennedy's funeral.
Hmm. Soon after the president's funeral, Jacqueline Kennedy directed that a book be written about his death. Why did she want that book written? And maybe you could give us some idea of what that book contains.
Well, it was a book, really, a trusted colleague, someone she knew, who I think she hoped would get the record straight. I mean, she knew there would be all kinds of attention about the life of Kennedy. And in the aftermath of his death, she turned to someone that she trusted to try to give a more complete insider's accurate picture of what went on.
Mm. The funeral observances for the president, what kind of impact did they have on the public, 1963? And did they act as a counterbalance to Mitford?
According to the funeral industry, they did. I mean, for them, you know, they weren't gloating, but they saw the response to Kennedy's death and his funeral as a real example of what they call the great American funeral. His body was not displayed, but there was certainly the kind of traditional ceremonial aspects about it that they thought legitimated what they do, their livelihood. On a more broader scale, one thing I'll say about the impact of his death was it was the first funeral that was covered by TV.
Mm-hmm.
So there was this media dimension to, in ways that were unheard of before, that created, if you will, a kind of national collective mourning that really brought the community, the national community, together in ways that you wouldn't necessarily see without television. So the media really broadcast a funeral, and people were really fixated to their televisions so that they were, from a distance in some ways, experiencing the funeral in ways that couldn't have been possible before television.
Yeah, I remember as a child, we had the day off from school that Monday,
mm-hmm,
in order that we would partake in this funeral.
Yeah, well, and that's such an impressive moment for many in that generation because it was so unheard of. I don't have to mention that today it's fairly a common occurrence to see funerals on TV and to have much more kind of media access to the death and disposition of certain figures.
Yeah. Mrs. Kennedy insisted there be no public viewing of the body. And I wonder, in the immediate aftermath of the Kennedy funeral, did that have an impact on funeral services in terms of what people wanted following the death of a loved one?
No, I don't think Kennedy's funeral did really at all. I really think it was Mitford who put the notion in the public sphere about not having to submit to the so-called authority of the funeral director and finding other, for her, less expensive ways to dispose of the dead. And also to keep the casket closed. For her, that was just a real outrage.
Mm-hmm.
And a very bizarre funeral practice that she thought was really sort of antithetical to the proper decorous way to mourn the dead.
Yeah, but it looked for a time that she might be overruled, apparently. That was interesting. I did not realize that there was a debate within the family, within the administration, over what was the proper thing to do.
Yeah, I was surprised, too. I mean, especially because, you know, his head's sort of blown off. And you know, he's immediately brought to a funeral home, and they immediately start embalming him in Dallas and trying to reconstruct the face. And so when they were making these decisions, there were some moments when they would actually look to see what he looked like and what kind of condition especially his face was in. And there were some who said, well, we can, thanks to the work of these funeral directors, we can have an open casket. But, that was overruled, and they kept the casket closed.
Mm. You also point out something that I didn't recall, that the president and his alleged assassin, his accused assassin, were laid to rest on the very same day. And both families had a private time with their dad.
That's right. Another of history's strange ironies, I suppose, that there was this, in spite of the vastly different circumstances of the funeral, there were some common elements, and one of them has to do with this, what I think is a deeply ingrained American desire or sensibility that revolves around allowing the family to have a last moment with the deceased. It's often with, you know, the casket open where you can actually see the person, but it may not always be that way. But before the body disappears forever, there is an effort in the ceremonies to allow for this sort of last moment of family, community, and attachment.
Hmm. And this is why you say that funeral directors then took charge of the body in the 20th century.
That's right. They took charge of the body. But again, there's a deeper historical sort of cultural commitment to having a last look that was an integral part of funeral ceremonies before the 20th century. It's in the 20th century that you, again, have these technological kinds of advances where you find ways that you can preserve the body for long periods of time. And also there is this effort, which for many people is offensive, is the kind of aesthetics of the corpse and being able to present a not an appealing but a recognizable form that people can visually commune with.
Mm. The importance today of having that last moment, is it different than having a last moment more than 100 years ago? It seems to me that it might be more important today because we are removed. The body is removed from, taken away from us, and it's in the hands of, you know, professionals.
I think you're right, and it's certainly a characteristic of what happens to the experience of death in the 20th century. I mean, in addition to the emergence of this now authoritative institution over the dead body, that is the funeral home, you also have the parallel rise of another institution that has quite a bit invested in death, and that is the hospital. The hospital also becomes, with doctors especially, a new place that controls not the dead body especially, but of course some aspect of it, but the dying process. So there is a sense in which people are very much, as you say, removed or distanced from death in the 20th century, which also, I think, as you say, only reinforces and strengthens this desire to kind of be able to be with the deceased one last time.
Hmm. When did we begin to see the rise of the funeral home, that separate place that is home-like, kind of?
Yeah, it's, as I put it, it's for the dead, a kind of home away from home. And it really is an incredible success story. I mean, I think funeral homes really emerged at the very end of the 19th century and into the 20th century. And within a couple decades, they're kind of an institution. They're on streets of towns and cities throughout the country, and they become a fixture of our experience of death in a very short amount of time.
We have a listener waiting to talk with us on the line, on line one in Champaign. Before we go to this caller, let me reintroduce our guest. This afternoon we're talking with Gary Latterman. He is the author of Rest in Peace, A Cultural History of Death and the Funeral Home in 20th Century America. Now let's go and talk with our listener. Line one, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I have my usual response to this question. I wanted to ask your guest, I haven't, by the way, read the book, and I hope to, but has hospice made a difference in the way we view death? Has it made a difference in resting in peace? Because we allow everybody, not everybody, every hospice family to be with the body. And that is my question, and I'll hang up and listen to your answer. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for the question. And yes, I think it is an important development in the more modern period and how we experience death. The rise of hospice really, again, is almost a kind of consumer revolt against the impersonal and more scientific culture of the hospital. And along with funerals, in the post-1960s era, there is a much stronger effort among people to control and manage their own dying and death, and not leave it under the control of the traditional authority figures, the doctor and the funeral director. And hospice is one example of a kind of popular revolt against traditional ways.
Yeah, and also the interest or the desire to die at home.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That becomes an alternative possibility for people who, again, want to, in their mind, preserve dignity, not have the kind of impersonal care that they often get in hospitals.
Mm. The shift from home to funeral home and the lead director, the funeral director, this person at the funeral home, did that change the role of the minister, the priest, the rabbi?
It did, in many ways. And part of the history that I try to tell includes the tensions that exist between local religious leaders and the funeral director. For the most part, historically, religious leaders and religion in general have been really the resources for people to use to make sense of death, to overcome their grief, to find ways to move on. And with the rise of, again, the doctor and the funeral director, in some ways those religious leaders get sort of pushed out, at least when it comes to the body and what happens to the body after death. Funeral directors become quite successful and effective in managing the details of funerals. So in many cases, when someone dies, the first person you call is not your local clergy, but the funeral director, who really tries to put it all together for the person, for the bereaved.
Yeah, one family member passed away a few years ago, immediate family member. We had some contact. I mean, the most immediate family had quite a deal of contact with the minister. But the rest of us had much more contact with the people at the funeral home.
Yeah. They really found a place for themselves that, in many ways, like the funeral home itself, becomes almost all-purpose in the sense that you go to one place where you can take the body is prepared, you can have your few intimate moments with the body and have a funeral in one space. The funeral director, in a sense, at the time of death, also begins to provide all of these various services that historically, you know, various other professions or people in different parts of society performed. It's sort of an all-in-one package.
It was very interesting because this particular funeral home had on staff a grief counselor.
Yes.
Who had, she had been a registered nurse. You know, in an earlier, in her previous career was as a registered nurse.
Yeah. Well, and that's a fairly recent phenomenon in the sense that, as I see it, early on, funeral directors really just were, early on in the 20th century, really saw themselves as primarily taking care of the body for the family, and that's about it. In more recent years, in the past couple decades, they have tried to also cover issues of grief. That is, they've tried to become, to a degree, experts or specialists in grief. And if they don't do it themselves, they often hire these consultants who work for the funeral home. But there's a sense in which, as they preside over the experience of death, for many there's also a new kind of responsibility that has emerged, which has to do with now not just burying the dead, but helping the living with their grief, who are trying to cope with the loss of someone close.
Mm. Gary Letterman is our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's Associate Professor of American Religious History and Culture at Emory University. He is the author of Rest in Peace, A Cultural History of Death and the Funeral Home in 20th Century America. This book, Rest in Peace, follows the publication of The Sacred Remains, American Attitudes Toward Death, 1799 to 1883. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with your questions and comments. Here are the numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. One of the fascinating aspects of your book is its attention to death in the imagination and in the collective imagination. And one of the things that you write about in Rest in Peace is the death, was the death and funeral ceremonies of Rudolph Valentino.
Mm-hmm.
What a story.
It's quite a story. And really, just when I came upon it, just seemed to reinforce a lot of what I was writing about. And it was so, you know, it's such a almost, I hate to say it, but sort of entertaining series of events that I had to find a way to include it in the book. And the basic story, as many listeners probably know, is Rudolph Valentino is really the first screen idol in many ways in this brand new industry known as movie land, Hollywood. And he died unexpectedly when he was young, and it just created a kind of a national response with people who were really, really profoundly moved by his death. And in New York, his body was actually put on display in the funeral home by a window for the throngs, what turned into mobs of fans who wanted, again, to see the sort of have a last look before the body disappeared for good. And so there are documentary kind of archives that show rioting, police on horseback trying to calm the crowd, people really clamoring to get a good view of Valentino's body.
Hmm. Another listener waiting to talk with us on line one, caller in Champaign. Hi.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Yeah, back in the 60s, there was a movie made called The Loved One.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like it's disappeared from the planet. And I finally got a copy. I had to, you know, get a mail order from the West Coast. What was the deal on that movie and the funeral business, anyways?
It's a great, great book. It was a book before it was a movie.
Right, Evelyn Waugh, I think.
Evelyn Waugh was the author, and it was written even before Mitford's book.
Right.
I think it's the late 50s it was written. And it's a classic, and before Mitford was a real spoof on the funeral industry by looking at the kind of activities goings on in a pet cemetery.
Right.
And so it was really ahead of its time, and the film was an underground classic. You know, I know it has Jonathan Winters and Robert Stack.
Right.
But
right.
it never really made it as popular and didn't have as kind of popular impact for whatever reasons that Mitford's book did.
But it was hilarious.
It's classic.
The movie, and I hadn't read the book, but I'd seen the movie back when I was in grad school years ago. And, you know, I mean, none of the video stores carry it. It's just like, it's out of print.
Yeah. Well, there are a few people who, it has a sort of cult status as far as I can tell, and there are a lot of people who really enjoy the film, even though you can't really come by it very easily these days.
Yeah, I just got a copy recently. But, I mean, did the funeral, what was the reaction of the funeral industry to that movie? I mean, I heard they just really didn't like it.
Well, no, they didn't. I mean, it was a real biting satire that for many struck a chord. Again, the book was before the Mitford's book.
Right.
And both Mitford and Waugh, of course, are from England, mm-hmm. so it's the English kind of commentary and view of what we uncultivated, unsophisticated Americans are doing.
I had just heard that the funeral industry tried to suppress the movie, and I thought maybe they succeeded. That's all I wanted to ask you about.
Okay, thanks.
Okay.
Thanks for the call. Other calls? Questions and comments are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, since we've been talking a little bit here about film, in terms of Rudolph Valentino and then The Loved One, Walt Disney, you know, avoided funerals. But death was certainly a subject that he explored in film. And you say in this way he acted as a mediator of ritual. Maybe you'd talk with us about that.
Well, this was one of those, again, great finds that historians come upon. And when I realized I was going to write the sequel to The Sacred Remains and look at death in 20th century America, to be honest, really, the first thought, image, idea that came to my mind was the death of Bambi's mother. And, you know, it's kind of, I remember that moment in my own childhood, and that led me on a research expedition, which resulted in a published article that I wrote called The Disney Way of Death. And, you know, what I argue is there's this undeniable presence of death and the idea of death or the threat of death in many of the early animated films of Walt Disney, all the way, you know, after Steamboat Willie. One of his first silly symphonies that he put together was a real classic that probably most of your listeners will remember mm-hmm. or have seen, called The Skeleton Dance, mm-hmm. which is an animated sort of cat fight in an old graveyard where to music. It's just a classic. But then you could go through and look at the end of Fantasia, Pinocchio, Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. I mean, that there was this very strong presence of death. It turns out in the research I did that Walt Disney himself was really fearful of death, of his own death, and was quite obsessed about it. So both the producer of these cultural, very popular cultural artifacts, and the content really expressed what I think is a very deep and strong American trait, which is a kind of preoccupation with death.
Mm. Let's talk with another listener on the toll-free line, line 4 in Dalton, Illinois. Good afternoon.
Hi, I got a question. Did you ever hear this story about Willie the Wimp and this Cadillac Oh, he was buried in his Cadillac, and he was really rich, and they, according to his wishes, they set him at the wheel, and Stevie Ray Vaughan did a song on it.
Oh, yeah. I've heard that. Was his name Willie the Wimp?
Yeah.
Is that really? Okay. I've heard these different stories about this guy who was buried in that setting. And, you know, writing this book, you just get all kinds of stories.
Do you know if it was true or...
Well, I believe it was true. Yeah. I mean, there are people who are buried in all kinds of different ways, especially recently. I mean, with cremation, you know, you can look at the fact that... who was Gene Roddenberry, the creator of Star Wars, or Star Trek, was his cremated remains were shot out into space, as well as Timothy Leary. So, you know, people, given the choice, will often make what for many will be unusual decisions about what should be done, what's the most appropriate way to dispose of the human remains.
Okay, thank you very much.
Sure.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. This is kind of a personal question, but doing all this work on funerals and funeral ritual, I wonder, you know, have you drawn up any instructions
for myself?
Yeah.
It's embarrassing, but no, I have not. I've let my wife know what I would like done, and my brother and my parents. But you know, I kind of let them know, but not in any real detail,
formal sense.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think that says you're normal.
Except I study this and have been writing about it for over like 10 years.
I read an article that says this is the last one.
That's right. declaring. Two is enough. The first one was really my doctoral dissertation that was published in 1996, and that was no problem. The second one, you know, I wrote it, and during the time I wrote it, I had kids, and, you know, my sort of relationship to death changed in a lot of ways with the second book, and now I'm very convinced that I will not write another book on death.
R.I.P. Rest in peace.
That's right.
it is interesting. We've been talking here about Rudolph Valentino, the loved one. By the way, a caller called in to let us know that you can order the loved one through Blockbuster.
Okay. Yeah.
So it's out there.
You can get it, yeah.
Yeah. The loved one, Rudolph Valentino, Walt Disney. And today we have a couple of examples of 6 Feet Under.
Yes.
And also Alice Siebold's book, The Lovely Bones, was just a huge bestseller.
That's right. And again, I take all of that as evidence for the case I'm trying to make, which is that we are quite obsessed with death. America's not usual. In some ways, I think every culture is very preoccupied with death and making sure that there are the appropriate imaginative, interpretive, and ritual responses to death so society doesn't fall apart. I mean, every culture in some ways has to answer the questions about death. And in popular culture and in films in particular, you can see a variety of different representations of the impact of death, the experience of death, how people deal with death, and fantasies about death as well.
Yeah. Now, when Disney's Dancing Skeletons got into the theater operators were worried that people would be outraged about it, and they weren't. I wonder if the people who have created 6 Feet Under had any kind of second thoughts about, you know, would that fly?
That's a good question. I don't really know if there were any any uncertainty about whether or not it would really be a hit. But it was created by Alan Ball, who is a great filmmaker. He wrote American Beauty, which is quite, you know, obsessed with the topic of death.
Mm.
Remember, the voiceover is from the lead character who was dead.
Mm.
And so I think, you know, HBO, which has kind of experimented and taken some risks with certain shows, went on a limb and, you know, sex worked for them, violence worked for them.
Prison?
Death is working for them.
Prison worked for them?
At prison, you know, I mean, and it gets at, again, this is HBO, so there's it's sort of seen as being more more open to many topics that really couldn't get on regular TV, and I think the popularity of these shows taps into certain kinds of American interests and sensibilities in graphic ways that you couldn't get, again, on regular television.
Mm. How does the industry, how do people in the industry feel about 6 Feet Under?
I think the response has been pretty positive. What I've written about it as really an attempt to break down the stereotype that's been so prevalent throughout the 20th century. I mean, instead of a one-dimensional, exploitative, corrupt, uncaring undertaker, you have this more nuanced and psychologically complex family who are trying to get by. So there, it's a very different and more complicated picture of life in the funeral home than what has really been mm-hmm. predominant through most of the 20th century.
Yeah. One of my favorite television shows was a little situation comedy that ran not very long, Frank's Place.
I remember that.
And it also, I thought, did funeral directors, people who work in that business, a great service. By
right.
humanizing,
right.
humanizing across the street from Frank's Place was the funeral home.
Right.
And the woman who ran it and her daughter were fabulous characters.
Oh, that's great. I should have talked to you before I published this. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that was an African-American?
Yes.
Yeah. And that's a whole other story that's quite interesting, because in contrast to that one-dimensional stereotype that really takes hold in the American imagination over the course of the 20th century, the in contrast to that were the African American undertakers, who, as far as I know, have always been very highly valued and respected by the black community, and you don't see the same kind of scandal and sort of journalistic muckraking mm. and journalistic kind of exposés in the black community over funeral directors that you see, for the most part, in the larger white community.
How would you assess the status of the funeral director today?
I think it's sort of on the road to recovery in some ways. He's becoming, well, at least in terms of the sort of large, I think at a local level, funeral directors have always been appreciated and respected. And that's the side of reality that Jessica Mitford doesn't really explore. At the national popular level, I think the funeral directors in some ways are being rehabilitated, thanks to shows in some ways like 6 Feet Under, thanks to the writing and popularity of Thomas Lynch, who's a poet and an undertaker. He wrote a very well-received book called The Undertaking a few years ago, and he's written in other national magazines, and he's just a smart and complex figure who goes against the grain of the typical stereotype. You also have a backlash in some ways against the big multinational corporations that have come in and tried to, you know, in some ways follow the lead of Walmart
mm-hmm.
and buy up funeral homes, which has led, as I said, to a kind of backlash where I found a number of newspaper stories that deal with the rise of the multinationals by almost having a kind of nostalgia for the good old days when the funeral home was run by the, you know, local family, something they've been doing for generations. So I see indications of a great deal more sort of cultural appreciation for funeral homes and funeral directors.
Hmm. Very interesting. Gary Latterman, I want to thank you very much for joining us this afternoon. Fascinating topic.
Thank you very much.
Gary Latterman is the author of Rest in Peace, A Cultural History of Death and the Funeral Home in 20th Century America. It follows the publication of The Sacred Remains, American Attitudes Toward Death, 1799 to 1883. This most recent book, Rest in Peace, A Cultural History of Death and the Funeral Home in 20th Century America, is published by Oxford University Press.
And that was an archived interview from AM 580's Afternoon Magazine from last August. It is currently 8 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, and settlement prices are now in from the Chicago Board of Trade. With those numbers, here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much. From the Board of Trade this afternoon, futures finished like this in the nearby wheat pit, down 6.5 cents. The March contract off that much. Had a high today of 388.5, a low at 376, a settlement price at 380.25. The traders saying that a lot of that is spillover from the soybean complex, which moved lower today on some ideas that bird flu spreading across the East Coast, and that could have an impact on how much feed, especially bean meal, would be going into the poultry flocks there. But we'll have to talk with Mike Zuzalo at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock this afternoon to see what he says about the weakness in the wheat futures. I think Mike may have a few more ideas than simple bird flu. May futures in the wheat pit, 394.5, the high, the low at 383, a settlement price at 386.5, down 6.75. July contract at 385, high today, a low at 376.5, and a settlement price there at 379.5. They were 4.5 lower. September contract for the wheat, 388, the high, the low at 380, settlement price at 383, down 4, and the December futures, 394.5, the high, the low at 387, a settlement to 390, down 4.5 cents. March corn now up a penny and a quarter on the day, 283.25 for the high, the low at 278.25, and a settlement price at 282.5. Once again, that March contract finished a penny and a quarter higher. May futures, 289.25 the high, the low at 284.5, a settlement at 288.75, and they were up 1 for the day. July futures, 292 the high, the low at 287, settled 291.5, up 1.25, and September corn, 285 the high, the low at 280.75, the settlement to 284.25, down 0.25 cents. December futures, 282.25 the high, the low at 277.5, the new crop December settlement price down 0.75 cents to 281.25. Now the March 05 corn, 284.5 high, low at 279.5, a settlement price at 284.25, it finished 0.75 cents lower. The July was unchanged on the day, 286 the high, the low at 84, and the settlement price once again 286 there, up on that high for the July 05 corn, unchanged. December 05 corn, 259 the high, the low at 255. The settlement price somewhere in the middle of that 4 cent range, 257.5 cents, down 0.5 cent. March oats, 150.5, the high, the low at 148, settlement price at 148.5, down 2, and the May oat contract, 155, the high, the low at 152.5, settled on that low. They finished 3 lower for the day. From the soy complex, beans, March contract, 830, the high, the low at 815.5, a settlement, 829, 7 cents higher for the day. May soybeans, 829.5, the high, the low at 816.5, a settlement price at 828.75, up 5.75. July soybeans now, 813 the high, the low at 802, settled 812.5, up 3.75. In September soybeans, 726 the high, the low at 720, settled 725, up a nickel for the day. November beans, 657 the high, the low at 648.5, a settlement price at 652.75, and they were up 3.75 cents. January contract, 658 the high, the low at 653, settlement price 654, up 4. And the March 05 bean contract, 659, the high, the low at 654. Settlement price, a penny off the high at 658, up 3 for the day. March bean meal now, 247.50 high, low at 241.50, settled 246.50, up 340. And the May meal, 245.80, the high. The low at 241.20, settled 245.20 up 220. March bean oil, 31.85 on the high. Low at 31.50, a settlement price at 31.72. They finished four higher for the day. And the May bean oil, 31.85, the high. The low at 31.45, and a settlement at 31.66, down three for the day. Now, here's Tom Rogers with the settlement prices from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
And thank you. An abbreviated trading day on the Merc today. We had a pretty much up day as far as the cattle goes. One contract ended slightly down, and the hogs were mixed as well. March feeder cattle had a high today of 84.25, the low 82.55, settled at 83.97.5, up 112.5. April, the high 84.70, the low 83, settlement at 84.55, that's up 97.5. The May feeders had a high of 85.85, the low 84.50, settled at 85.82.5, just off the high, up 100 on the day. And the August feeder cattle, the high 88.50, the low 87.20, settled at 88.47.5, again, just under the high, that was up 70. February live cattle had a high today of 76.40, the low 75.15, settled 76.12.5, up 7.5. March, the high 74 even, the low 73.10, and settled at the high $74, down 10. April live cattle, the high 72.90, low 71.52.5, settled at 72.62.5, up 12.5. And the June live cattle had a high of 70.70, the low 69.50, settled back above the $70 mark at 70.27.5, up 22.5. February lean hogs, the high today 64.20, the low 63.75, settled at 64.17.5, up 42.5. The April hog contract, the high 58.95, the low 57.85, it settled at 58.70 to close the week. That was up 32.5 on the day. May lean hogs had a high of 59.80, the low 59.20, settled 59.37.5, down 30. And the June also ended down 30 on the day. The high was 64 even, the low 63.25, settled at 63.80. February pork bellies had a high of 94.40, the low 93.20, settled at the high 94.40, up 165. And the March also ended up rather substantially, the high 95.10, the low 93.55, settlement same as the February at 94.40, up 120. Quick look at the outside markets now. In the Dow Industrial Average is down 67 points at 106.26, or check that, 10,626. The NASDAQ is down 17.5 points right now at 20.56, and the S&P is down 6 at 11.46. And those are the numbers.
This is Les Schulte, WILL's Director of Corporate Support. If you own or manage an agribusiness, you can help in supporting this valuable service on AM 580. To find out more information, give us a call at 217-333-0850.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Ben Brown from Augustana, Minnesota writes, "Dear Dr. Science, you mentioned that you're quite a coffee drinker, but you never give any advice about the actual preparation of coffee."
Yes, you're right. Although I've often mentioned the pungent, bean-full excitement in passing, I've yet to deal with the nervous system accelerator in great detail. Let's embrace the following set of coffee realities.